Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. Today, we discuss jazz. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex. Welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. So, jazz. Kind of a, I think a broad term almost for what we're talking about today.
Yeah, extremely broad.
So, today we're going to focus on the legacy of two great jazz musicians, Miles Davis and John Coltrane. There's a lot to get into with these, and we'll try to get away from just reading the entire biography of both of these musicians to you, because I think there's just so much to dive into, wouldn't you agree?
Right, yeah. And so what would you say is the, like, how would you narrow down this jazz, this subgenre of jazz?
Well... there it really isn't a one specific answer, because I mean, you have bop and hard bop and cool jazz, some fusion, free jazz even. I think that there's so much here. I mean, it's crazy that we're not even really talking about swing today.
Right, exactly, yeah. We're not even getting close to the beginning of jazz.
No, not at all. So this isn't in any way like a history of jazz episode. We're discussing two jazz musicians that we really vibe with and that we really love their music. So,
right. And we both think that they're really a little bit of a pivot point and a really innovative duo, even though they play together sometimes and they play separately a lot more of the time.
Yeah. I mean, they're both very progressive. I think they're both about the just creativity and creating new paths in the music world, really. And you'll hear us refer to these branching paths a lot in this episode, because if you listen to music today, you still hear some of these influences in pop and even rap and hip-hop type influences. There's just, I don't think that can be understated when we're talking about these musicians.
Yeah, massive impact on today's music. So let's jump right into it. Who's our first musician?
Well, like we said earlier, Miles Davis is our first musician that we're going to discuss today. I just recently checked out a really great documentary on Netflix, if you guys have Netflix. It's called Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, also a name of one of his great albums. So I'll give you a little bit of background on Miles Davis, born in Alton, Illinois, moved to East St. Louis, which kind of a rough town for African-Americans at the time, unfortunately. To give you kind of a time period, 1926 was when he was born, so this was towards the beginning of the Depression. On his 13th birthday, his dad bought him a trumpet, and I guess that that's where our story begins,
right,
here.
That's where it all unfolds.
And he would go out to the woods, listen to the sounds, and he would play what he hears. So that alone is a really strong basis in terms of creativity for what we have with Miles Davis. Right.
Yeah, definitely. I think you can really hear that in his music. You can definitely tell that he's inspired by emotions and nature and all of that. So it's really interesting to hear that he was playing imitation to all these.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to think that bleeds into his improvisation and just his general style. I totally agree. From the recordings that are a little bit more, we'll talk about later, the prestige recordings that were a little bit more of an obligation to him, you still hear that personality and the just the natural sense he brings to the music. And it's interesting because a lot of other studio type musicians at the time, while they would bring the goods technically, it was just not as natural, I think, as what Miles would bring to the table, it for good or for bad.
Right.
I think that there's something to be said in either direction. Where'd we leave off with Miles?
So basically right as he's getting into high school.
Yeah. So he sits in on the Billy Eckstein band with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. We'll reference those a few times. We'll probably do an episode or two on those guys. But mm-hmm. Charlie Parker, great saxophone player. Dizzy Gillespie, really, really great trumpet player from our state, actually, from South Carolina. And so that's really cool. Both were giants in the jazz world. Dizzy, kind of a proponent of the of bop and hard bop. Pretty good gig right out of high school, I would say.
Yeah, for sure.
Miles enrolls in Juilliard in New York. Booming jazz scene in New York, but then you also have great conservatory life. So his first week in New York, he actually was trying to find Charlie Parker and Dizzy. He can't find them. He's going all around, spending a lot of money trying to find them. And then he just runs into Charlie Parker on the street one day. And he's like, hey, I heard you were looking for me. I thought that that was a funny moment in the documentary, because you had Miles describing that. And I thought that that was pretty funny. That's a really cool thing, Fernando, about that documentary, because there's a lot of voiceovers from Miles himself.
Right.
And it's I guess they were made later in his life, just him talking in a little bit of a retrospective about how he got from period to period in his life. Kind of broad there, but it was interesting to hear it in his own words, I guess.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, he has a little bit of a humor to like the way he describes some of that stuff. So it's fun.
Yeah.
You guys should definitely check that out. Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool on Netflix. He's getting into all of these different kinds of music. Miles goes to Paris post-World War II. He loves it there. And jazz is becoming one of the great art forms in France at the time. So he's loving it.
It's interesting that jazz was big over there, because that's not, I mean, we kind of do associate jazz with France and with Paris, because it's got that romantic
but
and
it's
sweet
not overtly
feeling.
Talked about in like history type classes,
right?
I
yeah, I don't think that. I mean, I think we know that from the music history side. You can definitely see the influence of jazz on some of the classical composers during that time. But I don't think, a lot of people talk about that, you know, how jazz was growing big.
Right.
And that is really interesting. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, and connecting Miles with that is pretty cool, I think.
Right, that's an incredible connection to have there.
Yeah, with Miles and his time in Paris, I think that is an important and influential part of his career, because he had a lot more freedom in terms of not only just being a person, right? I mean, America was pretty racist and not a great place to live at the time. It was a hub for that, but then Paris was a lot more diverse and just a lot better of a time for Miles, right? And I mean, it broke his heart to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it would with anybody. I mean, I think both of us would like to move to
especially if you have strong connections with certain people or anything.
Yeah,
like, well, it would be
he tough. Met Pablo Picasso and Jean-Paul Sartre. So, I mean...
Right, right. And that exposure to different art forms, different people.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's an extreme cultural education.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And I mean, he brought some of his culture over there too. I mean, he helped cultivate that jazz scene over there. So I think that's definitely worth talking about.
Do you think that he had any influence in his playing from those two? You know,
you gotta think he did.
Yeah, because I can kind of see it too, with maybe with Picasso the most. I mean, that's the most I'm more familiar with him.
Yeah,
but with that, with maybe the cubism and stuff like that, the blue period, right?
Exactly. I mean, some of his more abstract music, I think you can definitely equate to maybe some of his fond memories of Paris, and maybe like some influences from some of the like impressionism over there. That wasn't necessarily as big at the time, but I mean, I'm assuming that he was exposed to that kind of stuff, so that's interesting.
Yeah, and like I guess blue was just a popular color in the world at that time.
Kind of blue, that's right. Yeah. So he's pretty depressed on his return to the U.S., like I said before, and unfortunately he has a little bit of a heroin addiction. So a little bit more grim there, but Miles' father takes him back home to try and help him break this addiction. So a little bit of a hiatus there, but makes this great comeback with his prestige recordings, the famous albums Cooking, Relaxing, Working, Steaming. And then this is where we start to get into at least Coltrane, John Coltrane, and he'll be the other great jazz musician that we're discussing today broadly. But he recorded with him these prestige albums, which were actually done over only three recording sessions, because Miles really wanted to be done with the prestige label, because he had gotten an offer from the Columbia Records, so he wanted to move on to there. So, and that'll be interesting to discuss when we go a little bit more in depth, but let's talk about Coltrane.
Yeah,
I think this is a good pivot point.
Yeah, absolutely. because Miles does keep going after he meets Coltrane, but I think this is the great intersection between the two, and we can kind of meet in the middle for that.
Rewind a little.
Yeah, rewind. Yeah. So yeah, we'll backtrack first, and then we'll come back to this meeting.
There is a method to this madness.
Yeah. So John Coltrane, he was born in 1926 in North Carolina. Not associate him with that.
Yeah, more Carolinas here. I love it.
Yeah, but he eventually moves to Philadelphia in 43, and soon after that, in 45, he joins the Navy after he had picked up alto saxophone and a little bit of clarinet in community band.
Oh, I didn't know that. Clarinet?
Yeah, he did play a little bit of clarinet.
Well, I guess. I mean, I pretty common doubling there, I guess.
Right, so. But once he's in the Navy, he's playing alto in 46. In the Navy band, he switches to tenor saxophone in 47. And then the GI Bill allowed him to take music classes after discharge from the Navy. So that was something beneficial for him. He gets a little bit more knowledge and stuff about music.
I'm just laughing here because I'm picturing that Coltrane playing in a Navy band today.
Right. Yeah. Well, you can find the pictures of him in uniform.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he showed me a little bit of those, or I saw him somewhere.
Yeah, so he was definitely in the Navy and definitely played in the Navy band. So that's pretty cool to think about.
Can you imagine him playing Lincolnshire Posey?
Right. That would be funny.
Or Stars and Stripes.
Right, right.
That's pretty funny to think about, for me at least.
Mm-hmm. So after he leaves the Navy, he was kind of a journeyman from 46 to 55. He played in some small groups and big bands as needed. He went from local groups to bigger national bands that were really hitting it off at the time. He played with Johnny Hodges, Earl Bostick, and Dizzy Gillespie's bands.
Oh, yeah, look at those names.
Okay. And right, exactly. These are heavy hitters in the big band community.
Dizzy's one he had in common with Miles. So.
Right, exactly. And that's actually when he's in Dizzy's band, he switches to tenor saxophone. So that's where he really makes the shift from alto to tenor.
Yeah, because he had been kind of back and forth up until that point. But right. I guess now he's more ingrained in tenor sax, which is good. I think that's the superior saxophone.
Well, I think saxophonists might have some issues, but
yeah, but they might. But I mean, I think that the saxophone is made to make the 90s sitcom type sounds. So, that historically, that might be a little bit inaccurate, but I think that's my take on the saxophone.
Right. Well, while he was with these groups in that period from 46 to 55, in 51 is when he unfortunately starts taking up heroin. In 55, though, he gets some great news, gets a call from Miles Davis to Miles wants him to join the Miles Davis Quintet. And so that's where we first get this intersection. They both were on Cookin', Relaxin', Workin', and Steamin' with the Miles Davis Quintet. With those albums, I think there's a great contrast and complementary playing between Coltrane's technical playing and technical abilities compared with Miles' playing.
Yeah, lacked a little bit more of the technicality that you came to expect of Coltrane. At least you do now if you know about Coltrane and some of his later works and even just Giant Steps. There's, I think that there is a pretty profound difference between their styles, and that definitely comes out in these albums.
Definitely. So when Coltrane is with Miles in the band, he kind of picks up the heroin addiction a little bit too much, and Miles isn't a big fan of that. I think Miles had been off of heroin at that time.
Yeah, he had been off of it, so he had seen what it had done to himself, and he really didn't want to see Coltrane going down the path, because he loved Coltrane. I mean, he hired him because he saw kind of a kindred spirit, I guess.
Right, right. So they were close, and Miles thought that Coltrane should figure that out. So in 57, Coltrane was fired from the Miles Davis Quintet. But that kind of led to some good opportunities for him.
This next opportunity might be his best.
Yeah.
Right?
So. Yeah. He sobered up while he was playing with the Thelonious Monk Quartet. And so Monk was a huge influence on Coltrane. Coltrane says of Monk, "I learned from him in every way, through the senses, theoretically, technically." So it's obvious that Monk had this really profound influence on him, and probably in his playing as well. I mean, I would say for sure.
Yeah.
And this was only in a few months, from July to December of 57.
So Miles introduced him to this kind of natural sense of freedom. And then I guess Monk gave him a little bit more of this freedom driven by what you can do with a great theoretical brain. And just you don't hear that as much with the early Miles albums with Coltrane. I think that that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And so also during this period with Monk, that's when Coltrane starts to seriously develop as a band leader and a solo artist, solo recording artist. This is when he releases Blue Train, and he also gets his distinctive sound and style, and it begins to be referred to as Sheets of Sound by some critics. So that's right. That's where you get that fast technical playing from Coltrane that most people know him from.
It's like a heavy, like... you know, those heavy sheets, I forget what you call them, but like,
like weighted blankets.
Yeah, the weighted blankets. that's what I think about, because it's just an endless stream of notes, especially in like giant steps. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's a barrage of notes. And so Coltrane eventually rejoins Miles in 58 after he establishes himself as his own person with his own style. And he's also sobered up at this point. And with Miles, they begin playing modal jazz, and this is when they record Kind of Blue, the
album.
That's
when you're
kind
in a mode to play jazz, right?
Right.
You're in jazz mode.
Yeah.
No, but it's a little bit more exploratory in terms of harmony, right?
Right. Yeah exactly. It's a little bit more, it's focused on different scales, or which are referred to as modes.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more combinations you can get out of that. And I've just from the improv lessons I've taken, I think that that has become a lasting impression on the jazz world. Because even when you're playing stuff that's a little bit more swing or big band based, I think that a lot of times, at least in my studies, I've been encouraged to go a little bit modal in terms of what I bring to the table. And it makes you sound, I guess, smarter and better at soloing when you go that kind of route. So
yeah, and so like I said, Kind of Blue was released during this period in 58, and also they recorded an album live called Miles and Monk at Newport, and that I think is also notable because you get Monk's music from that time, and then you get to hear Miles and Coltrane in the Miles Davis now sextet playing as well. So I think that's a really cool album to check out. Kind of Blue and Miles and Monk at Newport are the two from this period. But we're going to keep going.
Yeah, because I think that we will talk about later with how different that first group with Miles and Coltrane and then this group we just talked about with Miles and Coltrane, because it's quite the difference.
Right, yeah, quite the difference between those. In the next year, in 59, Coltrane started gigging with his own groups and writing more music. He jumped from Prestige to Atlantic Records, a bigger recording label that was able to give him a little bit more as a solo artist for himself, and playing with his own band and such. This is when he recorded Giant Steps, and that's known for the signature Coltrane changes. We talked about Giant Steps a little bit before.
Yeah,
that's where you definitely are hearing that Sheets of Sound, just
absolutely
craziness of notes. And basically, just to give a brief synopsis on Coltrane changes, they're just altered chord progressions that allowed for a little bit more experimentation to improv on, and Coltrane kind of coined that progression and the way that they work. So it's a little bit more complex than that, but we can't really get into that without bringing out the whiteboard and maybe showing everybody.
It's interesting to me. I've got to stop saying interesting. The fact that you have like these sheets of sound, and it's really harmonically complex and really modal, but you don't even really notice it because it goes by so fast.
Right. Absolutely.
It's just all of these notes just stream together, and it's really cool to listen to. And what we were talking about with Giant Steps, the album earlier, how the whole thing kind of merges together in terms of listening. That's why I think that it is a great listening experience, and it's so popular amongst the jazz world, because it's, I feel like that you have to listen to the whole thing to get the full experience, for sure.
Yeah, so that is Giant Steps. And then 2 years later, he recorded My Favorite Things in 61, which is a huge difference from Giant Steps. If you listen to Giant Steps and My Favorite Things, they're entirely different types of albums. And one of the big differences is that on My Favorite Things, Coltrane was playing soprano saxophone, especially for My Favorite Things, the title track for that album.
So you're telling me so far that he's done, since 58, Kind of Blue, the Miles and Monk at Newport, Giant Steps, and My Favorite Things.
Right. entirely different entirely different albums, and all within 3 years.
It such intense variety.
But wait, there's more. It's gonna get even wilder. So My Favorite Things, he's playing soprano sax. It's uncommon in jazz at the time, but that's kind of Coltrane's MO. He's going to be uncommon and innovative throughout this whole his whole lifetime.
Yeah, and I mean, just based off what we have next here, Ornette Coleman?
Right, so while he's doing My Favorite Things, while he's doing Giant Steps, I think, as well. Yeah, while he's at Atlantic, he's studying with Ornette Coleman, who's known for being a little bit more
eccentric.
On the, right, eccentric avant-garde side of music. You can see that he's starting to get into this non-chordal type of playing, that he's more interested in that type of playing. But he's also playing, at the time, very chordal music, especially with My Favorite Things,
yeah,
which is kind of a redo or a reharmonization and reinterpretation of a standard from a musical.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. My Favorite Things, I mean.
Right, and that's from The Sound of Music.
Yeah, The Sound of Music, yeah.
So he's doing the chordal playing, he's doing non-chordal studying, and he's about to get into the deep end. But first...
The deep end.
Yeah. But first he moves from Atlantic to Impulse, and he starts balancing between standards, like jazz standards, and avant-garde music.
So you're telling me, like, after all of this crazy stuff, that he goes back to standards.
Right. He's
like...
he's doing this balancing act between the two, just really classic jazz standards.
See, that's the mark of a great musician right there.
Right. Really classic jazz standards and avant-garde craziness. So when he's doing the standards, he even recorded an album with Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington,
what?
Super well known in
what
the
is
jazz
this man
community.
Doing? Like,
right.
This is crazy, honestly.
Right. So I mean, I can't even think of knowing and playing with Duke Ellington and Ornette Coleman.
So you have Duke Ellington, one of the great swing band leaders of the 40s and the 50s, and then he's playing with Coltrane.
Like, right. Right.
That's wild to me. That's so wild.
So all of this kind of culminates into the recording of A Love Supreme in 1964. And that's probably Coltrane's best known work, along with Giant Steps. But I think A Love Supreme is even more well known. And yeah, I really think that this is a culmination of all of these different influences that he's had. And for him, he called it an attempt to say thank you, God, through his work. Through music, he was kind of putting out a thank you or a prayer, maybe.
Yeah, so he's starting to become a little bit more spiritual at this point in
right,
his life. That
right.
Now that he's beat heroin and he's had this great career the last couple of years where he's had the freedom to do so much.
Right, so it's a big spiritual reawakening for him. And it was a big, big album that's split kind of into... a unique way for a jazz album. It's not just charts after charts.
I think Ornette Coleman had a big influence on this specifically, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. If you've ever listened to Ornette Coleman's music, I think it is very much an out-of-body experience. So I think maybe that opened his eyes to be a little bit more spiritual, I guess, is the best way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and part of that spirituality led him to doing a little bit extra with the album itself, the physical album. The album cover featured a letter to the listener and a poem, both written by Coltrane himself, and both talking about a universalist spirituality and addressing what he thinks his role is as a musician.
Okay,
so
yeah.
He's kind of starting to do a little bit more to add to the music. He wants this, especially this album, was a total package. He's writing
music. So he's starting to really take all of these teachings that he had and really put it into one medium.
Right, exactly.
Because you have this freedom from Miles that I think stuck with him, but then you have these great influences along the way that keep on giving with his music.
Yeah, for sure. It's an incredible album, and it really, that one got him the most popularity, probably. So, after A Love Supreme, he continues to go deeper into the avant-garde scene. He records Ascension, Meditations, Kulusei Mama, and Om. And you can really hear the progression of him getting more and more avant-garde.
Yeah.
At least for me, I can tell, oh, this one is before this one. And there's a progression of how far out he wants to get.
How out there would you say this music is in terms of just... I'm not as familiar with this music. I think you've shown me a little bit of this music, but this is kind of uncharted territory for me.
Right. So to give you just a little bit, a small dose of what's involved with these albums, there's some chanting that Coltrane does in it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ethnic percussion, right?
Yeah.
Not standard.
Which is super cool,
yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, non-standard percussion. And there's... How should I put it?
I think it's tough to categorize
albums.
Is the big thing.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is also that spirituality that we talked about.
Yeah.
So we have ascension, which sounds very spiritual. Meditations,
yeah.
A spiritual act. Om. All of these albums, they have a spiritual message around them, and I think that you really get that because it feels like that type of music that you would. That you would meditate to and that you would, you know, kind of just sit and listen to it rather than play it in the background or something.
Yeah, I kind of put you in a corner with those because I don't think I'd be able to put it better myself with those. Just from what you've shown me with these albums, I think you hit it on the head right there.
Yeah, yeah. Chants, non-standard percussion, some wacky notes and non-chordal playing, and then... some bells and whistles to go along with it.
Yeah. Is there bells and whistles?
I think there are bells. Yeah, I don't know about whistles.
Cool.
But
cool. So those albums have everything.
Pretty much.
So now let's take it into a little bit more of an overview. Let's talk Miles and Coltrane. We discussed their relationship in terms of the professional side of things, how they've recorded together. But Miles and Coltrane were born in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could have gone more different directions
with these
two, because you have Miles, who went a little bit more in the fusion and electronic side of things in the last years of his career. But then Coltrane, unfortunately, passed away early in 67. Yet, I would say that he went even further in terms of what he did with the instrument and his recordings. Why is that? Like,
I think it's the spirituality aspect, and I think he might have been inspired more by like the music of other countries and other continents.
Yeah,
right?
I guess so. And just maybe that he was a little bit more. I guess I don't want to say motivated to do so. But, I mean, with his life ending so suddenly, he passed away suddenly from liver cancer, it's amazing that in those last 10 years of his career, the variety is so intense and just so, I don't know how to put it.
Right, yeah, no, it makes sense. It is interesting that the variety is there, and it could just be because he was interested in doing a balancing act of standards and non-chordal avant-garde stuff. It
so
could
he
be
had
a lot
to be
of things.
Practicing constantly for this.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
I think his practice habits were pretty crazy from what I've read in various interviews. Originally, during the 50s, his practice habits were a little bit more haphazard, and he was struggling to find time to practice. I'm guessing that's from the balancing act of trying to build a name for yourself in New York and
in
just the music world in general. Yeah.
Big cities. Yeah.
Exactly. But then as he becomes a little bit more settled, and this is post Miles, he's able to do so much more. And it's because he just started practicing more.
Yeah. Right?
I think that he was just practicing hours and hours a day. And in an interview, he actually said that the reason why he has so many notes in a lot of his famous albums like Giant Steps, he plays so many notes, is because he just had so many ideas swirling around his head and he just wanted to get out as much of them as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then Miles was, he had a lot more space between his ideas. You know, he'd play a lick and then he'd wait a bar and then he'd play another lick and it'd be like two notes. It'd just be like dee-doop.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
And it's just like, all right, that's great music there.
Yeah, it's a different approach. I think they both have, it's definitely that
upbringing.
But
they came from such similar places, but it was apparent from the start when they first recorded with each other that Coltrane's technical ability was just far and away superior, not to knock on Miles in any way, but it was just true. And right. They're two completely different instruments.
Yeah.
But they were both born the same year.
Right.
So I think the comparisons are somewhat valid.
Yeah.
And at least from our perspective.
Yeah. And it all comes down to just their own interests at the end of the day. That was just what they were interested in. And Miles wanted to get into that electronic scene, and Coltrane was interested in other things. He was interested in that avant-garde and spiritual.
What if Coltrane had another 10 years, though?
Yeah, we were talking about that beforehand, and that is something that I really think about a lot. I think that would be really interesting if they would, if Miles and Coltrane would collaborate again.
Doing, like, the fusion type stuff.
Right,
yeah.
or a combination
I don't think the world could handle that music.
Right, yeah. Could you imagine the combination of Miles Davis fusion music with Coltrane's avant-garde music, a combination of that, and then with Herbie Hancock playing piano.
Oh my gosh. That would have been insane.
Yeah.
So the world definitely mourns the loss of Coltrane, because I think...
Right, and Davis.
Yeah, and Davis. I think they both had so much more to give. Even, yeah, Miles passed away early, considering modern age standards. He passed away at only 65 in 1991, so... I mean, that it's pretty sad that both had to leave us so early, but I think that what they gave us could not be understated. And now we have kind of something to bring this all together in terms of the jazz genre in general. We were talking earlier about this comparison with this period of jazz, where you have, just from what we've talked about with these two musicians, you have so much going on in terms of different styles that are being played, and that it's similar to another time in music history, right?
Right. For me, this innovation that Miles Davis and John Coltrane have at this period of time is so similar to the turn of the century, going from the 1800s to 1900s in classical music.
Yeah, with some of your favorite composers.
Right, yeah. It's really the beginning of something that really spreads out into this diverse field. With the turn of the century, we start going from romantic music into serialism and impressionism and other types of music.
Neoclassicism, neo-romanticism. I think the paths are endless. And then you have music you can't even categorize.
Right.
But then you have something like jazz that came from various inspirations. I mean, you have obviously the inspiration from traditional African-American folk music, but then also you have Scott Joplin, as well as, I would say, some of the harmonies of composers like Scriabin or Mio.
Right.
Right.
And they're both working off each other.
Yeah, they're not necessarily, I don't think that the harmony inspiration is overt necessarily, but it was inevitable,
right,
for other composers and songwriters to start to experiment with these types of harmonies. And then it just culminates in this explosion with everybody just going in all these different directions. And it's crazy, because it's really hard to pin down this point in history. But if we had to pick two for our first jazz episode, we decided to go with Coltrane and Davis, just because that between the two of them alone, the variety is insane.
Right. Yeah. There's so much diversity in all of their discography. And like I said, this is a turning point. This was a turning point in jazz, because we start getting into fusion and avant-garde music,
yeah,
from bebop. We're starting at, you know, at bop and,
yeah,
all of that music with Dizzy. And mm-hmm. They're playing in Dizzy's bands. And
yeah,
then they
and then
establish
they go
themselves.
And do their own thing.
Right. They establish themselves as their own musicians with their own styles.
Yeah.
And that's how we get to where we are today with music. But obviously there are tons of musicians in between.
Yeah. And I mean, we were going to discuss some jazz musicians like Cliff Brown or J.J. Johnson or Charlie Parker today, but there's just so much to dive into with all of these. It's not like discussing 10 classical composers or orchestral composers like we've done previously, where everything is so stark between a lot of them just based off of geography, right? But this was happening all in one hub at the time in the U.S. really, and then it starts to go in different directions, because you have like California, Oklahoma, and other states start to have their own versions of jazz. So it's just a whole lot of fun to talk about, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, it is a whole bunch of fun to talk about. So do you want to, let's give some recommendations.
Yeah, so, yeah, we've talked about a lot of albums, but...
yeah, but we're going to sum them all up for you right now so that you can get all of the recommendations right here. We're going to recommend full albums because we think that all of these albums have to be listened to in their entirety because it's an experience in itself.
Yeah, when I was on my way here, I stayed in the car for a little bit longer because I was listening to Kind of Blue, and I couldn't not finish the chart that I was on. It killed me not to finish the whole album, but Kind of Blue is a good place to start in terms of recommendation, honestly. Maybe not, actually. I think maybe something a little bit more standard, do you think?
Maybe, but I think to get a good feel of both of them playing,
I guess, I think, yeah, it's a little bit more modern of a representation of both,
right,
them playing.
And a lot of the charts are kind of well known.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Yeah, I think that all, I think it's five charts. Yeah, five charts on that album are really, really iconic. The Prestige albums, I love.
Right.
Relaxin' in particular is my favorite.
Right. And so which album has the studio talk?
Oh, Relaxin' has some of my favorite studio talk in it. Oh, I can't believe I forgot to mention this earlier.
And so what we mean by that is that there are kind of outtakes and stuff that you can hear from the musicians talking.
Yeah, Miles is like, I'll play it and I'll tell you what it is later. At the beginning, If I Were a Bell, the first track. And that was one of the first jazz albums that I owned myself, and that's the first thing I heard, and I'm just like, this is such a cool vibe right here.
Yeah,
because you're just hearing like how he would have talked in the studio. And if you know the story behind those Prestige albums, he was just trying to get those over with, Miles was, because he wanted to go to Columbia Records. But yet I think that these albums have some really iconic solo playing, especially in If I Were a Bell and You're My Everything, I Could Write a Book. All of those are great charts. another one of the funny quotes, I think it's at the beginning of You're My Everything, Miles is like, you're not supposed to talk while the red light is on. So he's like joking around. He's like, all right, guys, like, stop, we're recording. Like,
right.
But I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, it's really cool to get insight on... It's really cool to get insight into what it's like to be in the studio with Miles or with jazz musicians at that time. So you get a little bit of that feeling.
That's so cool to me. I think that's part of the reason why I gravitated towards that album. I will say, though, that we were saying Kind of Blue is a good representation of them in terms of their improvisation and a little bit more modern of a take on how they would treat a solo. I think that some of the solos in the Prestige albums are like more doodles, honestly, a little bit more doodly in nature, at least on Miles' side of things, because he would split notes a lot. He would crack some notes, he would make things that were like not so much in the style, just kind of like clear mistakes, you know. Not to I don't want to knock on Miles' legacy is playing, but I think that's worth noting that
it's super cool and super tasteful because they're musical mistakes.
Yeah,
right.
It doesn't take away from the enjoyment at all. It
adds to it for me.
Yeah. Because it adds this human element to it where you have these recordings today that are just like flawless and almost cleaned and mastered to a fault, I think, where it's so perfect that it takes some of the enjoyment out of it. But then with these recordings, the imperfections, like Fernando said, I think do help with the enjoyment in a sense.
Right. So our recommendations for Miles Davis are Kind of Blue and Relaxin' with the Miles Davis Quintet. Those are the ones for Miles. Let's jump over to Coltrane a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's a lot more to talk about in terms of what you're feeling if you want to get into Coltrane, right? Because there's a lot of different moods of Coltrane.
Right. But I think the big ones, the ones that are most well-known, are the ones that everybody should listen to. Giant Steps and A Love Supreme. Those are the two that I'm going to recommend because...
Favorite things.
Yeah.
That's just a little bit more out of the box.
Yeah. Well, I think My Favorite Things is a really good starting place. But if you're interested in getting into jazz, those are the staples that everybody's going to be talking about.
Yeah, specifically Coltrane, too, because when you mention Coltrane and you don't mention those two, which is like, are you stupid?
Right, right. So my favorite things definitely is one that gets talked about a lot, but Giant Steps and A Love Supreme, especially A Love Supreme. I mean, a lot of people talk about that, and that one's more accessible probably than Giant Steps.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree, because it's a little intimidating almost with Giant Steps.
Right.
Just the opening, you're like, hold up here. Like, yeah, this is not like anything I have heard.
Yeah. So those are my two recommendations, or our two recommendations for John Coltrane.
I think I'd agree with those overall.
Yeah. So to get a combined effect, if you just want to listen to one album with both of them on it, I think Miles and Monk is actually a really cool album. Miles and Monk at Newport is the name of the album. And this was a live recording, and you get a feel for both of Coltrane's influences, and you get to hear Miles playing. So John Coltrane is playing with Miles Davis's sextet at this time.
Yeah.
And you also get to hear Monk at the same time period.
That's so cool, because you have these three legends just playing the mess out of their instruments, and in a live recording too. It's not a studio recording. So
yeah, so that one I think is really worth listening to if you're interested in hearing those influences on Coltrane, and also just the music of Miles. Miles Davis playing and Coltrane playing on the same album, aside from Kind of Blue.
Yeah, so it has a little bit more of the modal influences, so you start to hear that creeping into their playing.
Mm-hmm.
Great, yeah. I think that this has been a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we gave everybody a good background on some of the most famous and well-known jazz musicians from the last
century. Well, this is just the tip of the iceberg, honestly.
Exactly. So we're just starting out with jazz, or just starting out with talking about jazz, but we love to get into this, and I'm glad we could start here, because it lets us go a little bit back and a little bit forward at the same time.
Exactly. So I would love to hear from you guys in the reviews, for sure.
Or by email,
yeah. You'll hear how to do that here at the end of the episode with the outro, but we'd love to hear from you guys some requests of some musicians to talk about in the jazz realm, because there's so many to choose from that we had a really tough time deciding for this episode, because we had like six or seven composers that we were really for sure gonna talk about, and then we narrowed it down to these two, and I think that this has been pretty long, so so I think that we'd love to hear from you guys, and also, be sure to check out our previous episodes if you haven't. We've had episodes talking about Nordic composers, musicals, and some of our favorite orchestral composers, so definitely check those out for sure. Fernando, do you have anything else for our great viewers at home?
No, I'm good. Just check out these albums that we talked about, Kind of Blue, Relaxing with the Miles Davis Quintet, Giant Steps, A Love Supreme, and Miles and Monk at Newport.
Yeah, absolutely. Great starting places for anybody who wants to listen for jazz. All right. Well, I think that's all we've got for today. Be sure to tune in next week for more of the Leading Tone Podcast, and we're signing off.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast, with no spaces, on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.